Welcome to the No Reserve Podcast presented by Bid Wrangler. Whether you're behind the gavel or in front of the screen, we're here to share the ins and outs, tips and tricks, and latest trends from the auction industry. We're diving into strategies that will take your auction business to the next level. So if you're looking to elevate your auction game, stay ahead of the curve, and connect with a community of like-minded professionals, you're in the right place.
Hello, and welcome to the No Reserve Podcast. I'm your host, Tim Peters, CEO and co-founder of Bid Wrangler, an online auction technology platform. This podcast is all about auctions, technology in the auction world, and an exploration into the best practices in the industry. So I thought our listeners would benefit from a series on what it looks like to build and operate an online bidding platform. Today, we're going to start by looking back 10 years ago when we built the first iteration of Bid Wrangler. With me today is my co-founder and business partner, Andy Harbick. Welcome, Andy.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Thanks for joining me today. Normally, I do an introduction of my guests, but I thought, you're my business partner. I'm going to let you introduce yourself and kind of talk to us a little bit about your background post-college up until the point where we started Bid Wrangler back in 2014.
Cool. Sounds good. So I went to James Madison in the mid-90s and graduated with a degree in computer science and bounced around a couple different sort of small companies and large companies. Some you've heard of, like Booz Allen, others you haven't because they failed. And I ultimately ended up at a very large company that everyone's heard of, Amazon. Me and my family were recruited to move out to Seattle in 1998. And I stayed out there in Seattle for 5 years, working on all kinds of things that you've heard of and used on that platform, from the email systems to customers who also bought to recommendations and customer reviews for toys and all kinds of different projects in that space. And then the last 5 years of my time at Amazon, I did from here in Virginia, where I built a team and operated a remote development center and worked on projects directly for Jeff, the CEO, former CEO. I guess he's just the chairman of the board now. And after that, I got recruited to Rosetta Stone, a language learning company, and spent 5 years there building a language learning product for them that was a first step into delivering an online sort of software as a service product with real-time classes with qualified teaching instructors and casual games. And there were a lot of ideas in it that were sort of leading edge. Didn't ultimately succeed in the marketplace at the level that we wanted to for a variety of reasons, but it was an amazing experience to build it. And I had an awesome team. Towards the end of my time there, I started pursuing a couple of sort of side projects and exploring different opportunities. I built a different product called Precarious, which is a attempt to figure out what would it look like if you merged together something like YouTube, TikTok, which didn't exist at the time, and Craigslist into a product that made it really easy to list things that you no longer want in a way that wasn't so heavy on typing lots of text and entering in all kinds of fields to list stuff. That didn't really go anywhere and wasn't the kind of product that I wanted to build, because it was one that needed a lot of money and a lot of advertising and a lot of sort of like growth hacking and Google ads and the sort of stuff to like get users as opposed to people that would pay value for the product. Like, I could never figure out how do you sell this thing for, you know, $10 a month or $20 a month or $100 a year. Like, I couldn't figure out a path that somebody would say, I will pay you to do this, because it just didn't strike as value. Like, you had to have scale, and that required an entirely different business model. And so in the midst of all of that, I went to Startup Weekend, where you and I met and began Bid Wrangler, and we could pick up the rest of the story from there. But ultimately, we partnered up and built Bid Wrangler, and it ate all of me. Like, it took, like, I quit Rosetta Stone, I quit Precarious. We went all in on Rosetta Stone and really did nothing else other than that. Quite literally, often in many days.
Yeah. I was so I got curious because I thought, like, we started Bid Wrangler in 2014. At least that's what I remember from our like LLC docs.
Yeah.
But then I started like Googling, trying to figure out when Startup Weekend was. but it was actually like April 5th, 2013, which somehow I kind of missed. So really,
we spent a good chunk of 2013 sort of like we went to that competition and had a great partnership, and we had a third partner, and we made something that was like quite impressive and exciting, and we won. And I think we spent a good chunk of that summer of like, do we really want to make a business out of this? Do we really want to finish it? Because while it feels pretty finished after a 54-hour burst of effort, I think we all knew like there was a lot of work to make it real. Like from boring stuff like how do you make a marketing website to advertise this thing that you made, to like more technical stuff like how do you get apps into the app store and get them all approved.
Password management. Email, like resetting passwords, like all the stuff that we didn't build in this prototype.
How do you charge for it? Like we didn't make any mechanism to... I think scrambling in the moments to our sort of launch at the NAA in 2014, I was like making mechanisms that we could charge for it, but like we didn't know if anybody would want to pay for it. So it's like, why are we spending time building for a mechanism to charge for what we built? And so like there was a lot of effort through 2013 figuring out, is this going to be real? Are we going to finish this? What do we want it to be? And then also like making an operating agreement and determining like how we're going to function in that way, and talking with lawyers and getting bank accounts. And then all of the branding stuff, like we've got pretty awesome branding. You're wearing an awesome BidRangler hat. Like we had to make all of that. We had to make the signs and the trade show displays and business cards. And so we did a lot of that through 13, and then a sprint in the early part of 2014 till the launch in July of 2014.
Yeah. So just for our listeners who might not know the story, like Andy and I knew each other socially, ended up at the same kind of conference for a weekend. It was called Startup Weekend at our local university, James Madison University. I was like 2 years into an auction company startup, a real estate auction company startup. And Andy was coming because he was curious and had ideas of what he might propose and maybe build a team around. And we pitched this idea and joined up as a team of building a mobile app for online bidding on your cell phone at the time. And Andy, don't think you slept for 2 days, but you built like a prototype that actually worked. We won the competition, which wasn't all that impressive because it wasn't a very competitive, like there were other people there, but they weren't building something very interesting. But yet, like we did a lot of research in that time, like in 54 hours, calling auction companies, asking if they would be interested enough to think, should we do this? I think there was reticence, like you had a full-time job. I'm in a startup that's an auction company. Like we took us a little while to get there. We had a partner that we ended up buying out who went and took another job. And then we decided to do this and started building and set up shop and came to conference and show knowing one person who was on the podcast last week, John Nichols. Like we knew nobody. Yeah. And it was like, we really expected to look around the corner in the trade show area and find that like two or three other people were doing the same thing and already had customers and we were late to the game. Fortunately, that wasn't the case. We learned a ton. We talked to a lot of people that had a lot of opinions about what we were doing right, what we were doing wrong. And we came back, ended up asking for advice from a mutual friend who was actually one of the founders of Rosetta Stone, where Andy worked. And the adage, ask for money, get advice, ask for advice, get money, which I did not know at the time, actually proved true.
Right.
And he said, yeah, I think you have something here and I want to be your partner. So we ended up getting funded to be able to build a team. And the rest was kind of history. But part of this podcast, I wanted to explore, like, what did it look like when we built that first platform? Because the platforms... like I thought about it completely wrong. Like I was like, it was like, I was building houses at the time. I was thinking, okay, we're building like a house that we can just keep selling over and over and over again. And the analogy totally breaks down because you don't really want to build a house that you keep putting additions onto. But really, we built a foundation and an architecture and a platform that then allowed us to continue to build more and more components on top of that to serve auctioneers' needs. But I thought it'd be fun for listeners to hear back in the beginning, like, what were some of the basic principles, like things that you thought like are absolutely necessary that we took the time to build right in the beginning, that if we hadn't, you know, we'd be in a place of completely rebuilding the platform once we had, you know, 20 customers, but that would allow us from really essentially having the same architecture that we started with, you know, 10 years ago, lots of new pieces, lots of new technology that's come into that that architecture, but we've really scaled it from like one customer to like well over 450 customers in a place. And I think it'd be interesting to hear what was going through your head at the time, all of the background you had, and obviously building scalable systems at Amazon. Tell us some of the thoughts you have around that and some of the principles that were guiding factors to give us what we were able to have and build on.
So like to help guide me in the places that seem interesting for the audience and go from there. But I think maybe some of the story begins with before Startup Weekend. I had just done some reading on a new technology that was pretty interesting called Firebase, which it matured and got bought by Google, and it still serves a part of what we do. But the kind of principle of it was sort of real-time data sharing. And it felt like a perfect fit for this particular problem because you've got a group of viewers, bidders, and a group of publishers like the auctioneer or the clerk that are sending information out that the bidders want to see. And then everybody's kind of participating in it, but everybody needs to have an up-to-date view of the world. Like every bidder needs to see that the current ask is $1,000 and that they have the opportunity to bid that or not. And if somebody bids $1,000, then the system needs to be able to know what to do to advance it, either by the clerk sort of describing the next increment or by a bidding schedule moving it up. And then all of the bidders need to know that the ask is now $1,100 and so forth and proceed through. And so Firebase was this kind of like novel thing. I was like, this is cool. I think this is important. But the kind of principle in it that felt like something that would power what we do going forward, and it ends up being an important distinguishing characteristic early on and even now, was real time. Like I wanted the data to be real time. The second thing that Firebase did well, and there's another technology I'll describe in a second, was mobile. It felt like part of the stories that we told when we went to NAA early on and that we even tell now, though maybe in a lesser extent, is that people participate in auctions sort of wherever they are. And we would say, you're at your kid's t-ball game, like you would participate in an auction. But if you had to choose between participating in that auction and being at your kid's t-ball game, you're going to choose the t-ball game. So like we wanted to escape that dilemma of choice, and that meant that it had to work on your phone. And so it was really important to build on mobile, to have every view that we make work well on the phone. I would say a third important principle was it was just me at first, like for a very long time until we could hire somebody. And so it's like you could have fairly large teams building all of these different things, but you couldn't have the sort of specialization of skills. You couldn't have somebody who is responsible for building the mobile view, somebody who's responsible for building the desktop view, somebody who's responsible for building the Android view and the iOS view. We needed something to sort of do it all at once. So like building in a kind of extensible way that works on all of the platforms was important. And an important ingredient to that was called PhoneGap. It sort of evolved and is now under the Apache project called Cordova. And it's a kind of framework that allows for building hybrid mobile apps where you use the same sort of tools and languages and technology that you use to build a website, for example, but you use it to build a mobile app, and it allows you to access sort of native capabilities on the phone, like push notifications or the camera or various other things. And that was another point of leverage that like I could build basically a web experience that works on a desktop. When you squish it down small, it works on a phone. When you wrap it with Cordova, it works as a native app and allows you access to push notifications or the camera or so forth. And all of those things allow for like one person to do a lot of building and mm-hmm. add a lot of value in a lot of different contexts. So like that kind of like works everywhere is maybe another principle. Two more thoughts on this and then I'll pause and you shift me somewhere else. One is that I would often say, and it sounds a little mean when I say it, but it's like we don't sell time for money. Like I didn't want to be a consultant. Like I wanted to build a platform. I wanted to build a company. I wanted to build value. I didn't want to be in a situation where it's like, you know, here's $200. You know, can you go make this tiny little feature or whatever? I didn't want to have to like manage those choices. I also wanted to have the latitude to say no. It's like as soon as you say yes for that money, you're kind of in a situation of like, this sucks, but you said that you're going to do it and you have a contract and you took the money, so now you have to do it. I wanted a little bit more freedom in that regard. But that principle sort of allowed us to sort of do some interesting things to aggregate demand from customers. So one customer says, I'll give you $1,000 to do such and such. And we say, we don't, that's not what we do. It's a really great idea. Let me go see if there are other customers that also want that. And then when you've got 10 customers saying that, you maybe lost the opportunity to make $10,000 by charging each of them $1,000 to do that thing, but you retained the sort of latitude to build it in a way that benefits everybody rather than being cornered into a particular place. And then you added greater value to the whole of the platform and the platform increases in value. So like resisting the temptation to take a quick buck and instead focusing very hard on what are the things that add the greatest value to the entire platform for the largest number of customers, you know, was sort of the pithy phrase of we don't sell time for money. Like to focus instead on we're building this platform for the benefit of all. It's a great idea. If others feel it's a great idea, we're going to add it. Or if it's just intrinsically a great idea and everybody else should learn that, we want to build it in a way that benefits. And we want the whole of the community while we very much focused on allowing white labeling and partitioning and multi-tenancy and the things that could sort of divide data. Everybody owns their own data. It is their platform, but in a very real sense, customers benefit by being on that same platform in ways that it's like, you got a new feature because somebody asked for it. It was a good idea and you didn't have to pay for it, but you got it because of the way that the platform works. So that sort of platform centricity. And then the last thought is, initially, all of the sort of backend administration tools, we used a framework called Rails Admin, and it was sort of like a quick and dirty CRUD tool, which stands for create, retrieve, update, and delete. This is the sort of basic functions on manipulating data in a platform, and it made it really easy and possible to do in a way that, again, saving myself time, I didn't have to build all of this administration plumbing to operate the system. I could outsource that to a framework and make it possible. Now, over time, we had to do a lot of work in that framework and beyond, and it ultimately evolved into BAM, which was a pretty massive lift to add the capabilities that you have to do on the back end. But sort of outsourcing some of the back end and early on, part of that was in our partnership with WaveBid. So like we could leverage the best of breed for some tools through our partnership with WaveBid, which again, we've sort of moved beyond that with BAM now. But early on, any way that we could find to sort of save effort to allow us to focus on the things that were most important, real-time, mobile, bidder-centric, white labeling and things like that. Anything that we could save time in that regard, we sort of embrace those strategies.
Yeah. That's a great like overview. I was thinking when you were just talking, like we've constantly built ever since day one, and like we're now on a schedule where we release one day a week. We don't usually release multiple times a week anymore. We have like a release day a week, which is good, but that's still like 50 plus releases a year. And one of the things that I think was helpful for me early on and understanding some of what you were doing and as you were teaching me was the idea of automated testing. And I don't know, can you try to explain a little bit of like how you thought about that in the beginning, how you made that a part of sort of the DNA of BidWrangler, because really that's a huge part of us being able to constantly build and release. And not that we've never had a problem where we've had to roll back because something didn't work, but that catches so much of like any issue that would come up with conflict in code, that like it's kind of our first barrier. And then of course we do like manual testing and we have other things we do here, but maybe just give like a little bit of a layman's view of what automated testing is and why that was important.
Yeah, this is something I feel very strongly about still. There's traditionally a way of doing sort of software quality and testing relies on a function called QA, quality assurance. And it's often in the form of a team that's hired, and developers would make something and pull it into a release, hand it off to a sort of staging environment that could be done for testing. And then this QA team would run through a series of scripts or tests, a set of rules that they would have to fall through and say it passes or it doesn't pass. And if it passes, then they would do a release. The trouble with that is I personally think that developers don't have a strong enough stake in the quality of their own software. Like, if you could sort of hand it off to somebody else, it's sort of like, I'm sure it's fine. And then they find a problem and then they send it back. And so you have a lot of inefficiency in that. But then there's also a lack of attentiveness to sort of future self. So like, I always say, like, I think about future Andy. And if you can be lazy, you don't think about future Andy. If you can't be lazy, you think about future Andy, right? So like there's a kind of bad social dynamic in this setup between traditional QA and software development. So an alternative is to make developers responsible for testing, and developers being developers, they don't want to like write a bunch of code and put it into a staging environment and then go through the exact same process that QA goes through. They don't want to solely take responsibility for that. Instead, they write code to test their code. And so the idea is I write a chunk of code that has certain expectations. It's a function which describes some set of behavior. It takes a customer ID, an item ID, and a bid amount, and it does all of the necessary things in order to apply that bid amount to that item and publish that information to the whole world. You can describe that behavior to a human being, so you can describe it to code. And so rather than just writing the function that takes those three parameters and does the behavior to publish a bid, you also write code to test it. And the code that you write to test it doesn't only try the sane things. It tries the insane things. What if I don't give it a customer ID? What if I give it a customer ID that doesn't exist? What if I don't give it an item ID? What if I give it a negative dollar amount? What if I give it a dollar amount that's less than the item? What if I give it a dollar amount that's more than the item? What if I give it a max bid? There's like 1,000 different permutations of any very simple function that could break it in unexpected ways. And so you write lots and lots and lots and lots and lots of tests to ensure that it works. And if you commit to that discipline of writing these tests, then over time, the quality of your code increases and the sort of durability of it increases. And then there's this phenomenon that happens that a system kind of codifies past learnings. So like you discover a bug, you fix that bug, it's now persisted into your system such that it shouldn't happen again in the future unless you make a change in code that causes it to happen. But if you're disciplined in writing tests, then whenever you find a bug, you write tests for that bug to ensure that that bug doesn't ever happen again. So if in the future you make a code change, you're like, oh, that wouldn't change this behavior in this particular edge case, your tests find that. So you have this repository of tests that prove that your code works the way that you intended it to work when you wrote it 6 years ago. And then you run those tests in an automated way such that anytime anyone makes any change to code in the system and commits it, it automatically runs the tests. And if the tests fail, it prevents a deployment, right? So it says, hey, nope, somebody broke something. Your past selves said this test was important, and your current selves are breaking that test. Somebody's wrong.
So it like, could be a test either from something 8 years, changed. It could be a test from 8 years ago, and you write a piece of code now, and when you go to run it through its testing, this test from 8 years ago says, nope, this broke. and then you've got to go figure out why and get all the tests to pass. Yeah,
exactly. And I think that's, and like, a lot of times, like, you know,
go ahead. No, I think that's
like a lot really... of times, like,
you go.
I'll wait. You go.
Are we delayed? I'll say it. So we're going to like definitely cut this little piece out. So I'm just going to start again. I think this is really interesting for people that are using technology to understand. And I'm saying it because I'm the guy who was using technology, and it creates security in me. Cause I mean, we do a code release a week, and I know that, well, nothing's ever perfect, you know, 98% of the time, like, the tests have already failed, you know, after they wrote it the first time, and they've taken it back three times to get it to where it functions within the ecosystem of BidWrangler, which provides a lot of security. And I just think people would want to hear about that. So, like, I don't know that we can understand much more than the depth of that, but I think it's really interesting that instead of a QA department that's human, that, like, could get lazy and not test the thing from 6 years ago or not run, you know, do all the right things. We really spent, like, haven't you said that we have more lines of code of testing than we do of actual, like, platform functionality?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, I haven't looked at the ratios recently, but it wouldn't surprise me if it were like 2-1, 3-1. It's a lot. And it is really important. So, like, you think about that sort of story of QA as well. When they've done their job and they're done, you've captured all of the value of that work. You can't get any further value out of it. It's almost like automated tests in and of themselves are kind of platform too. Mm-hmm. Not in the same way that BidWrangler is a platform, but like, if QA is a service and you pay somebody to spend an hour testing, when they're done with that hour, it's gone. You paid them and poof, you don't get any other value out of it. Whereas you spend an hour writing an automated test and you keep running it forever. It's like a platform that tests your platform. And you can have a lot of confidence in that because, you know, the humans that wrote it in the first place aren't going to forget, or the humans that moved on. Like, you know, we've had employees that took different jobs and I can't ask them, like, why did you do it this way? Tests sort of codify the expectations and validate that you're still meeting them and forced you to think critically when things deviate. And now that does happen. Like, you change the behavior of something, you break a test, it forces you to think, okay, did I really want to do that? Because our past selves thought it was a bad idea, which is why we wrote this test. Our current selves think it's a good idea. Let's debate it out and make a decision. So it is a powerful and crucial idea. I won't build systems that don't do that. I don't know anyone that's good that would build systems that don't have some degree of automated testing.
We know plenty of places that don't do it.
Sure.
Yeah. But cool. So thinking back to the early days, what do you remember as like one of the biggest challenges we may have faced in the early days? As I'm saying it, I kind of wonder if it was like doing it all myself. Or like hiring remote teams to like try to add capacity that didn't work out, or what I can think of some of those where we hired an offshore team to help build some stuff and then the code came in and you're like, you rewrote it all.
There's definitely like building a team and scaling a team and having enough resources, which like those are probably interesting, and maybe there's a whole conversation around that because it's not just software that we've had to build and scale a team. There's support and you know, sort of operations and sales and things like that. So maybe that's like a little less interesting in that sense. So I would say some of like the things that were technically challenging. I think one is while we gained leverage out of that platform called PhoneGap, which became Cordova, getting that to work well in a lot of different cases on a lot of different devices was, and to navigate all of the app store ecosystems was really challenging. Yeah. Oftentimes it was like debugging weird stuff. Like early on, when we decided to tackle audio and video streaming, the technology that it uses is called WebRTC, and on a iOS device, the underlying engine is basically the same engine as in Safari on your iOS device. And at the time, that engine didn't natively support WebRTC. And so the platform that we wanted to use to do the audio and video streaming wouldn't work on iOS. And so like there was a lot of kind of reverse engineering and debugging and hacking to like figure out how can we get this to work. And then ultimately we extended the sort of application with a plugin to this Cordova framework that exposed WebRTC capabilities so that we could use the platform so that we could work on iOS, right? So and then like it, what, as much as those platforms try to hide the distinction between each other, iOS versus Android, like oftentimes those abstractions leak, and it's sort of like it works on iOS and it doesn't work on Android. And so then you're okay, well, at one time I carried around like 6 or 7 different Android devices in my work bag because like something stupid would happen and I'd have to test it on a, you know, a Galaxy S5 or whatever. Now they're up to probably S20 or something. But so like you testing and deploying and bug fixing and working in the sort of native ecosystems to deliver on that core value of mobile, that was hard. And then dealing with the sort of policy BS of like Apple and Google and like and then doing all of this on behalf of customers, because it's hard. Like our customers are like business owners and they're salespeople and they're brilliant in their own ways, but they're not technologists, right? And I think what Google and Apple ask of people that want to have an app, which is not an unreasonable expectation of a business owner, is very technical and difficult. And it intersects sort of like the business owner in a way that it's like, you've got to have a DUNS number and you've got to do all of this stuff to set up a developer account. And you've got to pay your fees and you've got to authorize an email address. And there's like lots of relatively uninteresting technical stuff. But like when you ask non-technical people to follow through on and do those things, it's hard from a communication standpoint. It's hard from an execution standpoint. It's hard to get to the place where like, you could delegate me to release an app on your behalf in the store under your company name. Like that seems so trivial, but like there was a lot of challenges there. And then, you know, they would change their policies. And when they change their policies, they want to have sort of legal acknowledgement of those policy changes from the account holder. It's not me. I'm just releasing apps on your behalf. So then we would have to chase down the business owner to say, hey, can you accept these policy changes? Here's what they say. So like that is not a deep technical problem, but like it's part of the difficulty of operating in a sort of mobile centric world. So that was a big challenge.
I feel like a lot of this, so like the policy stuff has not gotten better, right? The technology side seems to have gotten better with WebRTC and like Apple and Google and sort of kind of everything rising up where, you know, we don't typically have the same, we don't have the same volume of issues where we're trying to sort through some of those things because they're a little bit more common.
Well, for a while, those guys, the platforms, Apple and Google, I think they were having a bit of an identity crisis. Like, what is an app? And will we allow this to be an app? And for a lot of times we had to figure out, okay, how can we work around the fact that they're declining our app for the fact that it doesn't do enough? Under like an arbitrary consideration, it's like, well, neither does this app, which is very wildly popular, and you approved that. So we spent a lot of time trying to get creative and or get a different reviewer to sort of pass the app, right? So it's like, it's cheating the system a little bit. So like, but yeah, there's a lot of that that I think that part's gotten a lot better. I think Apple and Google decided, okay, the thing that we do is completely within bounds and maybe they even appreciate it, but like we don't tend to have that kind of trouble anymore. That's changed.
That was like terrible. I remember those days of like, it wasn't just apps. It was like browsers on a given phone, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
A version of a browser on an Android phone that like wasn't doing something the way it was supposed to. And we'd go into this program called Browser Stack and we'd go emulate the exact same thing and figure it out. And then you'd have to figure out a fix to make this thing work and keep everything else working for the 59 phone types that are out there at the time using, you know, it was more than that, but like that most people were using. Which still can be a thing that we have to do some, but it's, I remember that. That's like, maybe I don't want to ask about the early days. That was stressful.
Yeah. Well, let me give you another stressful one. This one might cause an aneurysm or something, like dealing with, sort of scheduled jobs, asynchronous jobs, like delayed work, and doing that at scale and at volume. So, conceptually, in an online auction, an item is scheduled to close at noon tomorrow. Well, like the software's not always running asking that question. Something has to trigger the software to say, oh, I have something to do. I'm supposed to close this item at noon. But so that's tricky in and of itself. There's systems to do that involve various forms of queuing or saving jobs for later and then running them at a particular point in time. But then like, how do you do that in a way that's efficient so that you're not just constantly saying, should I run that? Should I run yet? Should I run yet? Should I run yet? Because if you're doing that now, 24 hours in advance, you're wasting effort. But if you do it 15 minutes late, auctioneers are unhappy, right? So like that part's not too bad, but then it gets more complicated because when it comes to noon tomorrow and the expectation in auctions is that if somebody bids at the last second, we don't want to support sniping like platforms in the past have supported. You want to extend the point that it closes. So somebody bids and instead of closing at noon, it closes at 12:02, right? And the more that you do this with the more customers on the more items in more auctions all at the same time, the harder it gets to sort of manage these jobs and make sure that they run at the right time without sort of destroying the database or losing jobs or getting items stuck. And then all of that has to be pushed out into the real-time ecosystem. And so a lot of that early on work was figuring out how do you do this scalably so that you could reliably close any size auction with any number of bidders all at the same time. And then, you know, the dynamics of a multi-tenant platform is that pretty much our customers are North American customers. So pretty much you've got three time zones that you're working with and four time zones you're working with. And pretty much that means that our auctions close from like 5 p.m. Eastern time to midnight Eastern time. Like this is the window of time with a peak around like 7, 8, 9 p.m. It's like the very nature of what auctioneers are doing to run their business is to aggregate demand, to get everybody to come at once, to bid all at the same time, to drive the price up. So like the structure of what they're trying to do creates technical challenges because you have to be able to handle that sort of spiky demand, right? And technically, you don't want to have a whole bunch of compute resources that you've saved up to live in that spiky moment just so that you're ready for the spike, because then you're paying for it at, you know, 9 a.m. when there's not as much happening. You want to be able to like to scale up elegantly and then scale down afterwards and have nobody notice and have it all work and never run into any problems. And that just didn't happen. We ran into a lot of problems.
Yeah, we got lucky. We ran into a fair amount of problems in the beginning, but I don't know. You built it really well and it scaled really well. You also had a lot of alarms. So like, yeah, there were times where there were problems that nobody knew about. Right. Like,
well, the other thing too is like
that the auto scaling may not have worked in the beginning. And then you have an alarm that goes off and you're like, we're hitting a threshold here that we shouldn't be hitting. And you give more resources. But
that would be like maybe another principle that I would say, like when I build stuff, like I want to know about the problems before customers know about the problems. So the way you achieve that is instrument the heck out of your systems and have ways to sort of like threshold alarms. And it's like, I know what my expected rate of queries is, or I know what my expected response time for these particular API calls are. And it's outside of the 99th percentile. Ooh, somebody needs to know about this. And it may be the case that customers are just like, huh, this is slower than I remember, which they're right. That's why the 99th percentile is alarmed, but it's not melting down. It's not working. And so then we get an alarm. So then you have systems that push that up through a kind of on-call rotation that sets off people's, you know, mobile phones with text messages and ultimately calls you or me. And then we're kind of fishing around finding engineers to say, what's going on? These alarms are going off. And it may be the case that it was nothing. It may be the case that like it's a spike that happened faster than I expected. We scale up and then it goes away and everything sort of self-heals. Or maybe the case that we need to look into something, but it's like, I want engineers to know before customers know. And you do that through sort of monitoring, logging, observability. And then maybe another principle in that too is like, even in situations where it goes sideways, I want it to go sideways in a way that you can unwind it, right? So it's like, it is like, we've had very few of these experiences where like something got messed up for an auctioneer, but it's not that we've had none. When it gets messed up, I want to be able to recover. Yeah, I want right. to be able to like have a do-over, right? It's not, I hate that. Like, I don't want that for our customers, but when it happens, we could say, hey, sorry that, but we can start it again exactly where it was at 7 p.m. We'll help you to message to your customers. We'll apologize. We'll make it right by you. But it's like, it's not, it doesn't, you know, it fails predictably and sort of reversibly is a kind of another principle to sort of not get yourself into a bad state that's unrecoverable.
Yeah, no, I think that's been really useful. I mean, I think more often that's been useful in places that we didn't stop auction companies
that's
doing
fair.
Certain things, right? Like deleting that's your fair. Auction in the middle of your auction, which has happened, you know, over the years. It used to happen once every 6 months. And then, you know, when you were there, we could be like, Andy, can you restore this auction? And you'd go back into the database and recreate all the registrations, all the bids, everything down to the very minute that it was deleted, and then reopen it back up. We took away the ability
and like,
to do that just because some of those things.
That same sort of like capacity, like it's beneficial in lots of ways. So like in that one of like, so the system works exactly as you would expect. I say, I want to delete my auction. The system says, are you sure you want to delete your auction? That's probably not a good idea. You say, yes, delete my auction. We say, are you absolutely sure? And they say, yes. And then we delete it and it's all gone, right? Like everything did exactly as it was supposed to. But like, how do you unwind that? So the system takes backups down to the second regularly. So we can, if we can know when you did it, we can recover to the moment before you did it, extract out the state at that point, apply it to the current state of the database and move forward. And part of being able to do that is a robust database system that allows us to do that fine-grained backup mechanism. Part of it also is really robust logging. Everything that I make has insane amounts of logging. Like, I don't remember. I feel like the last bill I saw, like we spend thousands of dollars a month just to log like what the system's doing. Like it's completely ephemeral and useless information from a business standpoint, like to our customers, they couldn't care less about that. But to like developers who have to figure out what the heck happened or why it happened or why is this bug happening, that logging, as expensive as it is crucial. It also ends up being part of that ability to recover to a very discrete moment of time. I can find the moment when you clicked the delete button against the advice of saying, are you sure you want to click the delete button? I can tell you exactly when you want. I can tell you what browser you were in, what IP address. Like, you can tell a lot of information, and that information is crucial for recovery. So
yeah,
recoverable systems, lots of backups, that sort of thing is an important principle as well.
Man, I feel like we could go on and on. Like, we keep unwinding this. And it's like, I forgot about logging. Like, when we were talking about this, but there are just so many of those pieces that like I'm so thankful that, like, you know, this wasn't like me and you post college saying, let's start a bidding platform with zero experience. This was kind of me with no experience, but this was you, like, having done, having built a lot of things and had other people that, like, you worked with that were brilliant as well to build into, like, yeah, fundamental principles that would help us. And I don't think I realized how important it was, you know, in year one. We had, like, two customers, but now, like, I sleep at night way better because I know how the system works, how many redundancies are in place, how many alarms are there, and how infrequent something can really, don't like to say this, but, like, how infrequently something can go wrong before we know it, right? It's, yeah, that's a rarity in our system. And that doesn't mean that we don't ever do anything wrong. It's
well,
nice.
Oftentimes, like, even how we roll when out those code, happen,
even when we roll out code, like, we definitely had lots of times in the beginning days, we'd roll out code and then, like, something would go wrong. Maybe not like terribly wrong, but, like, a customer would call and be like, this doesn't look like it's working right. And we'd be like, roll back the code. Give me 1 minute. Yeah. And you'd roll it back and we'd go back and then, like, everything would be fine. And we're like, what test? Like, all the tests passed. What did we miss? And some of that was, like, learning sort of the most vulnerable places, I think, as yeah, well. And then doing more manual testing as we grew our team and whatnot. But I'm really thankful for those, like, early days of spending the extra time to build the things. I can feel how important it is as we've been building BAM. I mean, we have more developers working and we're releasing more, like, features every month. I mean, we're releasing code every week, yep, but new features every month that, like, without that, like, I feel like it could be a train wreck. It would be a train wreck. There's no way you could test. There's so much in our code base and so many different ways to do things. As much manual testing as you wanted to do, you would have problems if you released every week. And I'm really thankful for a lot of those.
The other, one last thought about testing, like, a nice dynamic that happens when you commit to building automated testing is you make smaller changes. Right. So, like, if you go and you make a massive feature with sort of lots of things that you need to test, like, the act of going back and writing tests for that massive feature disincentivize you from doing it. And so, like, you can step on this slippery slope of lazy behavior. But if you've built a discipline and a culture around doing it, you make smaller changes, and smaller changes are always safer. So, like, yeah, I think that there's just lots of ways in which that idea is benefiting us. And then you get to release more often, right? Like, tiny little change, well tested, guaranteed success in launching it, guaranteed, means you can release more often and more confidently.
Which, like, again, just for those who aren't really that familiar, which is why we live in one code base. Like, you were diehard in the beginning, like, we're never going to fork this code to where we have, like, we build this for this customer only and they get use of that. But that all of our code base and all of the features are available to all of our customers. You know, if they joined 8 years ago, they have a much more robust product today than they did 8 years ago. And if you join today, in 8 years, it's going to be that much more robust, but it's one product. Yeah. And I've really, I think that's sometimes hard for people to understand because there are other folks out there who will build just for a given customer, and that's fine. But I think there's such value in sort of the collaborative thought and ideas that come from our customers that then get built into the system in ways that everyone can make utility out of them, which is what I think makes, you know, BidWrangler a great technology solution. But yeah, thanks for all of that. I hope that we can do this again. And I have thoughts about maybe what does it look like to build a feature, like do a case study on something that would be, like, really easy to and tangible, but think about, you know, when we're talking, like, how many different aspects of the platform that touches for different use case scenarios, and kind of think through how do we go about taking a feature request from, you know, Chris writing it down, and he thinks about it and tries to write down a GitHub issue of all the different ways it's going to affect this and that and the other thing, and then a developer taking it and starting to work it out and going through review. And, like, I won't go through all of it right now, but I think it'd be a fun podcast for us to do later. But I think we're sitting now at 49 minutes, which is my pinnacle of podcast time so far, which has been really fun and hopefully is fun for listeners to listen to. But thanks for the time you spent here, and we'll do this again soon.
Sounds great. Thanks, Tim.
Thanks, Andy.
Yep. Bye.
And that wraps up another episode of the No Reserve Podcast presented by Bid Wrangler. Thank you for joining us in exploring a dynamic world of auctions. We hope today's episode has provided you with valuable insights and actionable strategies. Don't forget to visit us at bidwrangler.com to stay up to date on the latest auction technology, trends, and community stories. And while you're there, drop us a line. We love hearing from our listeners. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the No Reserve Podcast on your favorite podcast platform. Your support helps us reach more auctioneers and enthusiasts like you. Until next time, keep your bids high, your reserves low, and your passion for auctions burning bright.